Okay, big one from the US. Big one insofar as there are lots of different things I wanted to cover today. And frankly, it has been a really big week. And I thought maybe I'd start there just by sort of sharing what the travel scenario has been like the last few days. Because frankly, it's been kind of hell. So as many of you know, I travel to a lot of events. I've been doing a lot of events, like particularly over the last 4 years since I've had my joyful, joyful life of independence. And I have never missed an event. I have come a little bit close. I remember once in New Zealand about 5 years ago, I came very, very close due to flight delays and things. Still got there on time. So this time, I've headed off from Australia, and I'm going to try and remember what my dates are this time. I was in Melbourne. Took a moment to think about that. I was in Melbourne earlier on in the week. I went there. Geez, when did I go there? Oh, this is getting hard work. I went there on Sunday. And the plan was I was going to leave Melbourne early on Wednesday and come to the US, except the problem was I already had all my US stuff booked. Melbourne was a sort of a kind of last minute thing because we did the NDC stuff I'll talk about in a moment. So anyway, I had to fly from Melbourne to Brisbane and then from Brisbane to LA and then LA to Denver. And the plan was I was going to get to Denver and do this keynote for Snowfrock at 9 a.m. Thursday morning. Anyway, I get to the airport in Melbourne at stupid o'clock. It was like 5 a.m. or something like that. And they're like, oh, your connection from LA to Denver has been cancelled. The American Airlines one was, don't worry, we'll put you on a Delta flight. A little bit of a long layover, it was like 5 hours. Not great, particularly in LAX. Don't worry, we'll sort it out. Oh, by the way, you can fly from Melbourne direct to LA instead of going to Brisbane first. Sweet, save me an extra flight, no problems. So anyway, like I get to LA and I go to the check-in desk to check into Delta, and they're like, oh yeah, the flight's delayed 2.5 hours. So now I've got like 7.5 hours in LA. All right, don't worry, I'll go into town and I go to Beverly Hills just to look at the cars. I could not care less about all the shopping. I just want to watch the cars. So yeah, I do that, back to the airport. Oh, it's been delayed again. And now this is like Wednesday afternoon and I've got to do a 9 a.m. keynote in Denver. And then eventually they go, oh, it's been cancelled. So basically Denver just had like this massive blizzard, like this crazy, I don't know, once in a year or once in many year kind of blizzards, and I timed it. So yeah, it's going to be the next day, so I've got to go and stay in a hotel in LA. Don't worry, 8:30 a.m. flight the next morning, speak to the organisers, yeah, we'll just push the keynote back. Get to the airport. Actually, before I even get to the airport, I get up, which morning? Thursday morning. And they're saying, oh, it's delayed an hour. All right, crap, go to the airport. Delayed another hour. And it's sort of getting to the time where it's like, I'm going to get to Denver and everything's going to be over. And I'm starting to think, do I have to just skip that altogether? And again, like I've never had to deal with this before, not like this. The New Zealand thing, it was just the one flight. I was on the plane sitting on the tarmac in Singapore and I got delayed a little bit. Long story short, I end up getting to Denver at like, when was it, 4:30 or something like that. And then we land and I'm like looking at my watch going, am I going to make it? And the captain's like, well, we don't have a gate, so we're going to have to wait for the plane over there. By the way, it's been sitting there all day, and now the crew have to change because they've been there too long. I don't know when we're going to get a gate. And I'm looking at the terminal going, it's right, like, can we do the slide? Or like, how can I get out and just go to the thing? Eventually get there just before 6 p.m., like when the whole thing's meant to be wrapped up. But I did get to do my keynote, which is really, really cool. So I spoke about an hour. Then I had questions for probably nearly an hour. Then we had dinner and things like that as well. So I managed to get to Snowfrock and do the talk, which was an absolute freaking miracle because I was convinced there for a while that there was just no way it was going to happen. But it was like literally get out of the car and the organizers there at the door and like walk in straight up to the podium, like do my thing. It actually went okay. I didn't have any sort of technical glitches or things, which was like I said, a freaking miracle. So I did that. I come to New York the next day. So this was a ticket that I already had planned. It was unfortunately a very, very early flight on Friday morning. It was a 3:45 get up. But because of my stupid brain, knowing that I have to get up and jet lag, I got up at like 1:15. So 1:15 on Friday morning. By the way, this is why the video is late. Like I've just been absolutely smashed. Anyway, did fly to New York. Got to New York, got to have 1 hour rest, and then we had a Pluralsight event in this room that you see here. So this is a very nice room. It's probably one of the nicer rooms I've had at conference events because we had about 14 people sitting at the table over there on Friday evening doing a cyber thing. It was sort of a Pluralsight invited a bunch of their customers, which were C-suite execs and things like this that wanted to talk cyber. which we did here. This is, for those of you from New York, this is the Chatwell Place in New York. So I did this, went downstairs, had some dinner, went to a play, and, you know, like, ask me how much I felt like staying awake at a play after getting up at 1:15 that morning. So I got, like, halfway through the play and just went, oh, I got to go to bed, and left the thing. But it was a really good night, met a bunch of really nice people, had a nice dinner as well. So did all that in New York. When was it? Saturday morning, I went and recorded a piece with NBC as well. So NBC is doing a documentary on data breaches, so I went and caught up with those guys, did a whole bunch of Q&A and bits and pieces that should go into a documentary about data breaches, which would be quite fun. You see how I, like, maximize these trips, right? And fortunately, since then, it's actually been a lot more relaxed. So this is actually my first trip to New York. I went for a wander around. It's, so far, all the things I expected New York to be, like just super, super busy, just noise everywhere, but you know, action and excitement and stuff everywhere as well, which is kind of cool. Caught up with someone from the Twitters last night, which was very nice. And then today I've got to move on to other things, but I might kind of talk about those a bit later. Now, on events and things. And look, I hope people are interested in what happens at these events. So I know that it's not necessarily directly a cyber thing, but it's something that consumes a great part of my time. So this is how I got here, reversing back a little bit. I did do the NDC meetup in Melbourne on, I don't know, when was it? Oh, my God. Earlier on in the week, before I came here. No, when was it? Tuesday night. Right. Tuesday night, Australia time. And we booked it out. I think they've, I don't want to say sold because we didn't sell tickets. It was free. 500-odd tickets. They all went like a week before the event started. We did this at the National Australia Bank there in Melbourne. They had actually a really, really good facility for this. We packed that out with people. And similar sort of thing to the Snowfrock keynote. Spoke for about an hour, did Q&A for an hour or something. But that was a really, really good fun event. We're doing this again in Sydney next week. I think it's next week, but of course my schedule and stuff's all over the place. Let me actually check. So this is going to be, you know what, I favorited a tweet with this in there today. Let me see. When am I going to Sydney? So this is this is the joy of, like, time zone chaos, right? Like, you just totally lose track of what's where. Sydney, 28th of March. So we're doing this at the Microsoft Reactor. We're doing this with SSW as well. So Adam Kogan, who many people know, is going to be there emceeing that one. So we'll be at the Microsoft Reactor on the 28th of March, which I think is going to be Thursday next week. Next week being, well, it depends where you are in the world and depends when you think the week starts. Anyway, it's going to be the 28th. So we'll do that. That whole thing will sell out as well, just as Melbourne did, just as Brisbane did. And again, selling out is you get a free ticket. So go and, you know, jump on that. Oh, by the way, we are giving away free NDC tickets as well. We actually gave away a few in Melbourne, so this is an opportunity to get a ticket worth quite a bit of money to go to NDC either on the Gold Coast later next month or in Sydney in October. So well worth the effort if you score one of those. Okay, so that was the NDCs. Incidentally, if you're watching the video, you may notice I've got this little black clippy thing on my shirt. This is the Instamic, which I spoke about in my last couple of weekly updates. Really neat hardware execution. If you remember, I think last week I was reading the response I got after reporting to them that their firmware update process may have a few little issues, namely being that the firmware update process relies on you entering some personal information into a non-HTTPS address on an IP address, not even on a domain, which then sends you an email with a link to download the firmware over HTTP from the same IP address, so you have no authenticity or integrity or things like this of the URL, and then you get firmware which is not signed. And I reported that, and they went, no, this is the correct process, you'll get the right... they have not replied since I went back and said, no, this actually isn't very good. So I'm a little bit disappointed about not getting a reply on that. I might even follow them up, because it's like these are kind of the fundamentals if you want to ship any sort of binary to someone. Like, you've got to sign the freaking thing, and preferably serve it securely as well. All right, so that was that. That's the Melbourne one. That's the Sydney one. Coming up this week, I've got an event tomorrow. Excuse me. And I've had this nasty cough. I don't know what it is for the last few weeks. I'm not sick, but just a tickle. Anyway, So I've got an event tomorrow in New York. I don't think this is one that they want to make public, so just believe me, it's cool. I'm going to do that and then get on the plane to Seattle. So that's a hell of a flight. It's 6.5 hours from New York to Seattle, which I guess is not that much different from like Brisbane to Perth. You know, they're both big countries, but it's literally one side to the other. So I will arrive in Seattle at a really, really unpleasant hour, New York time, and an hour that's not a whole lot better Seattle time either. Anyway, I'll be over to Seattle, and then I'll be at Microsoft MVP Summit for Tuesday and Wednesday. I'm missing Monday because of the event here in New York tomorrow. And then the regional director add-on to the MVP Summit Thursday, Friday, and eventually returning home to Australia on Saturday, or leaving Saturday. I have no Sunday. I'll arrive on Monday. So anyway, I'll do this next weekly update, probably, I suspect, from Seattle, and I suspect on Saturday morning, so it'll be late again, but that's just the only chance I'm going to get. All right, data breaches. So there have been two big data breaches that have loaded in since the last weekly update. Now, one is HOWZ. I think that's how you pronounce it, H-O-U-Z-Z. 49 million records in there. Now, in some ways, it's just another day in data breach land. So this is actually one of many different breaches that got announced by the Register, of all places. It seems like the Register's article was the first that some of these companies knew about the breach. So anyway, that went into the Register, downloaded the data, all legit, 49 million records. I loaded this into Have I Been Pwned, and then I got a breach notification on my own email address. So my own email address was in this breach. And I actually want to write something about this if I can find some time to do it during the week, but I had no idea I had an account there. And to be clear, I did have an account there. This is not something that was fabricated or anything, because I went and pulled the data, and I want to actually show my own data in this blog post. But in a nutshell, my data was in there. I had a username of TroyHunt22, which surely was just auto-assigned to me. My old Hotmail address was in there. The date of this record was June 25th in 2017. And there was an IP address on here. And there's a little section here. I'm not sure what the name of this attribute is, but the value of this attribute is GB, as in, I assume, Great Britain, /H9, /London, /EC4N, which I even wonder if that's a postcode. Anyway, the IP address does actually map to London, and there's this London reference, and I went through my TripIt, and I was in London at the time. And I can only assume that, you know, I guess nearly 2 years ago, I created an account on HOWZ whilst I was in London, and I just forgot about it. And I guess the thing that struck me is, like, I think a lot about data breaches, obviously, and if I don't know when I'm in a data breach, you know, short of Have I Been Pwned telling me, like, how does everybody else know? This was kind of a shock to me. It was honestly a shock. Like, I got the email, and literally the tweet I put out was, for fuck's sake, I'm in another data breach, and I didn't even know it was coming. So, yeah, I guess it's just like chalk one more up for me. I think I'm up to like 16 in Have I Been Pwned now. So that was HOWZ. The other one that I just loaded over breakfast today was Ixigo. Now, if you've not heard of Ixigo, Ixigo is... What exactly do they do? It was... Oh, man, I just put it in the tweet. But because my brain is kind of crunched this week, Ixigo does... Oh, why didn't I say it there? Anyway, it's in the data breach description. Actually, if I go to the front page of Have I Been Pwned, it will tell me, won't it? But there's sort of an interesting follow-up to the Ixigo thing. Let's see. Let's reload that page. Oh, come on. What if I go to Who's Been Pwned? So one of the problems, not problems, I guess, but one of the side effects of the aggressive caching that I do on Have I Been Pwned is when I load a new breach, it can take sort of half an hour sometimes for this new information to appear. But what I did before is I went to Wikipedia and I went Ixigo like this. Indian company, Ixigo. Ixigo is a travel and hotel booking e-commerce website found in the year 2007. Now, for the most part, again, this is like business as usual in data breach land. The thing is that this was also one of the breaches which was which appeared recently, just after that Register piece. Actually, the Register covered a whole bunch of breaches, and then shortly after that, the same player popped up on this dark web marketplace selling a bunch of other breaches, including Ixigo. And the only reference I could find to this was news pieces. Now, normally, what I would like to do is find a disclosure notice from the company saying, hey, we had a data breach, here's what we've done, here's what happened, so on and so forth. The only reference that I could actually find here was a story, or rather the only comment I could find from Ixigo was a story with a headline of Ixigo CEO denies breach of user data, says payment information not stored. Now, it's kind of interesting the way this plays out. So that the byline here is, we have not found any evidence to confirm this breach. As of now, although we continue to investigate further, security experts. Okay, reasonable. Now, the story goes on. And it says, the company on Saturday morning has sent an alert to its 100 million users over the alleged security breach and asked them to change their passwords. Now, for a company to say, we have not found any evidence of the breach, which is a reasonably solid denial, and then say, by the way, we asked everyone to reset their passwords, seems to me a little bit contradictory. Now, that does give me pause for concern insofar as I want to make sure this breach is legitimate. Now, at this point, you know, the organization's saying there's no evidence of a breach. You would think that they've investigated this pretty well. So I'm looking at the data. The very first record in the breach is the CEO's record. And I tweeted a redacted copy of this and said, you know, has anyone actually seen a disclosure from this company? You know, the first record is the CEO. Now, in this tweet is his name. I've obfuscated out the alias of his Gmail address. Probably no surprises that someone has a Gmail address. And then there's a link to the guy's Facebook profile. So it's only like public information anyway. He did since get in touch with me via DM. In fact, he got in touch with me via DM just before I did this recording, and I won't say exactly what the guy said, but you know, because it is a DM and it's private. I will say though that I did reply to him and offer to help them verify the breach. Now, just to be clear around verification, so what are the things that I have to do to verify? Well, the first thing I did when I got the data, or when I started looking at the data a few days ago, was what I would normally do with a breach like this, which is go through, suck out all the email addresses. There's just over 17 million of them. Then I would go through those and I would grab a bunch of Mailinator addresses. I'd go to the password reset feature on the site, plug the Mailinator addresses in. Does the password reset feature either have an enumeration vulnerability which confirms on the web page whether the account exists or not? And yes, Ixigo does, which most websites do. So I'm grabbing like random Mailinator addresses from the breach data, plugging them into the website, and everyone's coming back saying, yes, we've sent you a password reset message. If you fat finger another address, it comes back and says, no, this address doesn't exist. So, you know, here's sort of the first thing. If you're grabbing a random selection of addresses, albeit Mailinator addresses, but a random selection of Mailinator addresses from an alleged breach, and then the website is saying, yes, every single one of these exists on the site, your confidence level's kind of starting to go pretty high. You know, in addition to the fact that this was in the press, this is being sold by someone who has a history of selling legitimate breaches. I mean, this is a person who was selling House and MyFitnessPal and MyHeritage and everything. All of those were legit and acknowledged by the company. As I drilled more into the Ixigo data just over breakfast now, basically, I was going to say every record in there, but I don't think it was every record. A lot of records had MD5 password hashes, yay, or because sometimes I had both, connections to social media profiles, like to Facebook profiles. And every Facebook profile it linked to then did actually line up with all the other data attributes that were stored in this collection of JSON data within the alleged, I think we can say actual, Ixigo data breach. So I was going to say there's no doubt in my mind, but I'm always conscious that there is the possibility for something to go wrong. There is a 99.x% confidence level in my mind that the data is legit, and sometimes the organisation just needs to be walked through to help them understand. In this DM, I can read what I said. The last DM I said right here is, incidentally, in my experience, taking ownership of a breach, if it indeed did happen, is always preferable to denying it. Happy to share my experiences. there and point you to useful resources. I know it's not a pleasant thing to deal with. And it's not. And look, I am always sympathetic to a degree to organizations that are at the receiving end of a data breach. They did not plan this. They did not set out for this. Sometimes there are egregious oversights that lead to it, and there are certainly there is certainly some accountability on behalf of the organization. But it's not a pleasant place to be in. And I would much rather help organizations like this understand what happened, get them to communicate with their members, because have I been pwned? Like, I'm only going to notify my subscribers that are in the breach. I want to make sure that everyone knows. But mind you, the news piece did say that they did notify everyone, but then said that there was no evidence that it happened. So who knows? I don't know. We'll see what happens between now and the next weekly update. All right, so that was data breaches. That was Howes and Ixigo. I did get a blog post out this week, and it was a very ranty blog post because, frankly, I was a bit fed up with this shit. And it was related to the cookie warnings that you see on so many sites. Now, just for a little bit of context as to why I felt compelled to write this now, because we have seen cookie warnings on websites, in particular from the EU, for many, many years. We've certainly seen them for many, many years before people started taking GDPR seriously, certainly before it hit and people started preparing for it. So it's not just a GDPR thing either. And that the title of this blog post was, "These cookie warning shenanigans have got to stop." And here's the catalyst for this. So there was a TechCrunch article, which, let me read this to you. The headline here is, "Cookie walls don't comply with GDPR, says the Dutch DPA." This is the Data Protection Authority. And effectively, what the Dutch DPA is saying is that you get these cookie warnings and you really don't have much choice, you know? So, you know, imagine you're a Dutch person and you go to a website and it's got a cookie warning and the site's basically saying, "We're going to set cookies and track you. Click here to agree." Now, there is no "click here to not agree." The "click here to not agree" is a little X on the tab on your browser, which effectively says, "I'm not going to use the site." So people don't have the choice to use it without tracking. Now, this is kind of, like, I get what they're saying, but there are multiple problems with this. And in fact, I'm just going to read a quote here. "The Dutch DPA's guidance makes it clear internet visitors must be asked for permission in advance for any tracking software to be placed, such as third-party tracking cookies, tracking pixels, and browser fingerprinting tech." We'll come back to fingerprinting. "And that permission must be freely obtained, ergo a free choice must be offered." Now, ironically, this is on TechCrunch. If you visit TechCrunch from the EU, you get this really nasty cookie warning. And the cookie warning basically says, there's a sort of, "Before you continue, TechCrunch is now part of the OAuth family," not OAuth, because when I first read it, I was like, okay, OAuth is OAuth a family now. "We and our partners need your consent to access your device, set cookies, and use your data, including your location, to understand your interests, provide relevant ads," there's the key, "and measure their effectiveness. OAuth would also provide relevant ads to you on our partners' products. Select OK to allow OAuth and our partners to use your data, or manage options to review our partners and your choices." There's then a big blue button with the word OK on it. Now, for Aussies, this is not a problem because we just don't see this, because apparently Aussies don't deserve the same level of privacy. Americans don't either. So there's that, and I have a bugbear with that. Like, I have a bugbear with the way that we are dividing down the world such that some parts of the world are perceived to have a greater degree of right to privacy than others, and that is just shit in all sorts of ways. Now, mind you, if you inverse that, it's like Australians and Americans get a much better UX because we don't have to see these stupid cookie warnings in the first place. Now, the thing is, though, you look at this and there is one big, very clear button with OK on it, which is standing between you and the thing that you are there to do, which is to read the story. What are people going to do? They're going to click the big blue button. Now, they're going to click the big blue button because that's the easiest way of actually getting through to the content they want. But also because if you do actually want to drill down into configuring the policies for effectively app by app or tracker by tracker, I forget the actual number, I'm trying to find it here. But It is crazy how much configuration there is. So I actually VPN'd into Amsterdam, loaded the same page, and then I've got a screen cap scrolling through all the different partners that TechCrunch uses that you, as a European, can go in and configure tracking for. There's 224 different ad networks. So there's like a list of 224 different ad networks, and you can go through and configure each and every one to your own preference. Just to read a story about how cookie warnings are kind of shit. And this is ridiculous. And then that's the that's those ones. These are the IAB partners, the Interactive Advertising Bureau partners. There's those ones. But the Oath family, which is what TechCrunch now appears to be part of in terms of ad network, this includes things like Amazon, DoubleClick, eBay, Crux Digital, and Nielsen Marketing Cloud, amongst others. You can't turn those off. You can go through and read the privacy policy for each one. When you go to read the privacy policy, you're prompted with another cookie warning on the website on which the privacy policy is on. And assumably, you now need to do the same thing. Read their cookie warning, go through, read their partner's config. This is ridiculous. It doesn't make any sense whatsoever. Like, no one is going to read this. And the thing that kind of gets me worried, bringing this back to a security context, is that we're now in a situation where someone is going to a website, they're getting a warning in their browser, and they're just clicking OK to get through the warning and actually read the content they want. And frankly, those warnings, from your normal, average, everyday person perspective, are not fundamentally different to warnings such as deceptive site ahead, Google's safe browsing, hey, this is a phishing site, or warnings around things like the fact that your connection is not secure because the certificate is not valid for the site. And what worries me is that we start to condition people to click through the warning just to read the content. And in case you're looking at it and going, well, yes, but they're security warnings and they're fundamentally different to cookie warnings, firstly, I don't think your average person really understands that. And secondly, I've got a tweet in here where there's even a German bank telling people to click through certificate warnings because they've misconfigured a cert or something and they think that that will be okay. So this is just like all kinds of level of ridiculous. And I'm going to read you just the summary here because this sort of, to me in a nutshell, spells out the problem. Everyone clicks through cookie warnings anyway. If you read them, you either can't understand what they're saying or the configuration of privacy settings is a nightmare. Depending on where you are in the world, you either don't get privacy or you don't get UX hell. If you understand the privacy risks, then it's easy to open links incognito or use an ad blocker. You can still be tracked anyway because you can fingerprint the browser, even though the Dutch DPA thing said fingerprinting also needs to have the warning, but the point is you can't just turn off cookies. And finally, the whole thing is just conditioning people to make bad security choices. So this got a lot of traction, and it was kind of interesting to sort of see the responses to it, and they broke down into a few different categories. Overwhelmingly, it's like, yes, all of this is shit, we should stop doing this. But there are also a few other things that popped up here. Now, one of them was a lot of people blaming ad networks. This is the ad network's fault. They're responsible for all of this. Kill the ad networks. Get rid of ads. And I hear what you're saying because ad networks have gotten way too invasive and the tracking is way too invasive. And I don't like it myself when I go somewhere. And I remember when I was buying some headphones a few years ago, look up the headphones, you know, Google for the headphones, and then I'm on some other website, totally unrelated, and they're trying to sell me headphones. Like, this is a negative experience. This is, like, it feels shitty. I totally get that. The problem is, as I've also written, I wrote a blog post or link to about how ad blockers are part of the problem, is that we have this continual sort of situation where we want to go to websites and get content for free, and then we're complaining about the monetization strategies, and we're implementing techniques to try and block the monetization strategies. So they're getting ever more invasive and saying things like, please turn off your ad blocker or disable your VPN or things like that. And that's, again, all kinds of shit. And the whole thing just keeps escalating and escalating. And for the people saying, well, you know, ads are dead, we should be using micropayments and things like that. Well, clearly ads are not dead. And if micropayments worked so well, everyone would be doing it. And they're not. It's an exceptional thing that you actually see that instead of an ad network. Oh, by the way, I just learned the other day, speaking of monetization strategies, apparently CoinHive is dead now. So yay to that. For those of you that didn't know, CoinHive, that was a way of monetizing your visitors by putting a crypto miner in JavaScript on your website so it would just run up CPU cycles and mine a little bit of Monero coin and send it off to you. Anyway, those guys are gone. And also part of the problem with that is that everyone who managed to compromise a website was putting crypto miners on the website and then taking the Moneros back for themselves. Tangential story. So there was this, the whole blaming the ad networks thing, and I don't disagree with that, but it is a much more complex thing than like just turn off the ads, because you and I still want these websites to exist. I enjoyed reading the TechCrunch story. Didn't even have to click through a cookie warning, being an Aussie. Now, the other thing, and this is the one which I'd really like to write more about at some time, but it's going to inflame things. It's a lot of people talking about GDPR. And there are a few different themes here, but I think the thing that came through most of all was people saying these are not GDPR compliant, or GDPR doesn't mandate sort of representing information in this way. And effectively referring to the fact that GDPR is meant to look for informed consent, where people actually understand what they're opting into, and they can, as a mere mortal, actually comprehend the messages and make informed decisions. And then lots of people saying, you know, these are not GDPR compliant, this isn't what GDPR means, that is what GDPR means. And I don't even want to get into that, because there's one thing that is absolutely undebatable about GDPR, and it is simply that loads of people argue about what the spirit of it actually means. They will argue about whether this is compliant, whether it's not. They will blame it for this, they'll blame ad networks for other things. And it's just this, the thing I'm lamenting is I was so excited about GDPR, and I was so excited because I was looking for something which would start to hold organisations more accountable when they make fundamentally egregiously bad security decisions and they have data breaches. I hate the fact that the regulatory penalties for data breaches are almost non-existent. You know, it's like take TalkTalk in the UK. So TalkTalk, that was an absolutely catastrophically bad event perpetrated by a 17-year-old with SQL Map. You know, like how high was that bar? And the fine they got was, I think I figured it out, it was like 0.022% of gross annual revenue. So it was £400,000 and they got revenue of about $1.8 billion a year. So I remember, because I had this in a slide, but the mathematics was like, if you earn $100,000 a year, it's a $22 fine, which is basically like a nice lunch. You know, how does that incentivize an organization not to have data breaches in the future? So anyway, I was very happy about the whole concept of a regulatory body with some teeth to stop this sort of stuff. What I really don't like is how we've now ended up in this sort of messy thing where there's just loads of different interpretation of what is required, loads of different interpretation as to what is informed consent. Stuff like this is an absolute mess. Frankly, any warnings whatsoever about cookies are an absolute waste of time. And I heard from all these people saying, well, this is not really what GDPR means. You really should give people an option so that they can say yes or no and that they can make an informed decision. Do you really think your average person can make an informed decision about tracking and privacy and cookies? You know, like actually understand what it means? Well, no. Tell you what, ask your average person how they feel about fingerprinting and see how much they understand that. So I don't see any way you can actually do that and have people clicking through something that they actually understand. And I think this is the heart of it for me. If people are going to get warnings about things and they're important, security warnings, privacy warnings, unless they can be represented in a way that they actually understand and they genuinely are informed about, they're just an absolute waste of time and they're conditioning people to just to click through and say yes. And I cannot see any feasible way that this makes sense. And even if it does, again, I'm still lamenting the fact that I, as an Aussie, for some reason, get less privacy than someone who is Dutch and they're in Amsterdam. You know, like that just to me feels like a very nasty way of breaking down the web. And one more thing on this as well. This is going to upset people. It's all well and good to sort of say, okay, we have this regulatory body in the EU, we have this set of regulations in the EU, and this is what it means. I think it becomes enormously problematic when you then try and extend that out onto other organisations in other parts of the world. So, you know, the TechCrunch thing is a good example. TechCrunch is a US organisation. They are trying to implement things to satisfy the EU and then do different things for other parts of the world. How an EU regulatory body is ever going to bring a case against the likes of TechCrunch if that message isn't quite right isn't quite clear at the moment. And for those of you sort of going, yes, well, extraterritoriality, etc., I've got a blog post in draft at the moment that's showing some of the responses from local DPAs when EU data subjects, GDPR doesn't actually say subjects, citizens or residents, data subjects. So when data subjects have actually been submitting complaints through to some of these regulatory bodies, it's interesting to see their responses where they've gone, well, actually, this company is operating in another part of the world and the chances of us bringing a case against them are very, very small. So I have a number of examples of those, particularly as it relates to data breaches of data aggregators. And I'm just trying to spin this into a narrative that doesn't just make people lose their mind. But the logistics of actually enforcing something like that on a company in another sovereign state is not so trivial as people would like to think. So anyway, look, that's my cookie rant, and again, it's not just cookie because it's fingerprinting and other tracking things as well. I really hope that this thing looks fundamentally different in the years to come because it's just an absolute shit fight at the moment. All right, last thing. So I do have a sponsor this week, and of course this week is now kind of next week, but it has been Veronis. And again, Veronis is sponsoring every alternate week for about the first half and a bit of this year. They've got a piece on there at the moment about their DFIR team investigating a data breach, which is very interesting stuff. Veronis does do some super cool work. And I've done a bunch of different talks for Veronis in the past as well, and they are always super cool people. And I'm not just saying that because they're sponsoring my blog. It really has been a pleasure working with those guys. So, look, that's it for this week. I hope that's been useful. I know it's late, and you're probably now watching this into the next week, and probably the same thing's going to happen next week as well due to this travel schedule. But hopefully after that I might get back into some more semblance of normality. Actually, I won't because the week I get back on like a Monday morning at 6 o'clock or something, and on Wednesday I'm going back to Sydney because I'm doing a keynote at Akamai event in Sydney on Thursday, on the same day that I'm going to do the NDC meetup for Sydney. And then I'm going to be doing another talk the day after. Not sure if I can talk about that one, but I'll deal with that at the time. So the next two might actually be a bit late. Regardless, I'll keep pumping them out because I think that it is a cadence that I'd like to keep. So thank you for watching. Hope it's been useful, and I'll come to you probably from Seattle next week. See ya.